Topic 1, Censorship of Obscenity, Part 1. This is the 11th educational program produced by the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union as a public service. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director. Today's program will be the first in a series of programs dealing with the problem of censorship of obscenity. Last July, the Metropolitan Airports Commission passed a resolution instructing its staff to tell news dealers to remove from the bookstands certain books which the commission felt were obscene. These books included books by Henry Miller, John Cleland, and other authors. The news dealers adhered to the resolution and removed not only the books they were asked to, but others as well. At that time, the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union Board issued a statement, which we will discuss at a later program, discussing the civil liberties implications of such action. Recently, the Minneapolis Police Department Moral Squad, three officers of the Moral Squad, went to the Lower Edge Art Gallery in Minneapolis and removed a painting from the walls entitled The Lovers, arrested the director of the art gallery, and charged him under a Minneapolis ordinance of exhibiting an obscene painting. The Minnesota Civil Liberties Union provided legal defense in the form of a friend of the court brief, making a motion before the court to suppress the painting as evidence because of an illegal seizure. This motion was granted. Following this, there was a trial in Hennepin County Municipal Court before the Honorable Neil A. Riley, judge, at which the art gallery owner was found innocent of the charge of exhibiting the painting. These incidents point up the problem of censorship of obscenity. And in these programs, we will discuss some of the implications, the constitutional problems involved in such censorship, and the position of the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups and organizations in relation to these problems. In 1962, the National American Civil Liberties Union ended a three-year review of the issue of censorship of allegedly obscene materials and issued a statement at that time saying that the constitutional guarantees of free speech apply to all expression. The National ACLU Board emphasized it was neither urging the circulation nor evaluating the merit of material charged with being obscene, asserted in a policy statement its belief that limitations of expression on the ground of obscenity are unconstitutional. But the ACLU said, if obscenity laws are invoked, prosecution should be based on clear proof that the material would cause in a normal adult behavior which has been validly made criminal by statute. A special exception would be permissible, the statement went on, if the target group of the allegedly obscene material were children. In these cases, the standard to be applied in judging such material should be whether its effect on children would lead to behavior that would violate a criminal statute. In explaining its position that the First Amendment covers all forms of expression, the American Civil Liberties Union said it recognized the genuine concern of parents, clergymen, and the community about allegedly obscene material. But ACLU stressed in its statement, the right of expression under the First Amendment was too frequently abridged under the now vague and uncertain standards of obscenity which now operate. The statement said, even under the Supreme Court's 1957 decision of obscenity in the Roth case, which is whether to the average person applying contemporary community standards, the dominant theme of the work, taken as a whole, appeals to prurient interest and is without redeeming social value. The statement points out that courts and juries continue to differ over what constitutes obscenity. This was certainly pointed out in the recent court case, which we will discuss in a later program. And I believe has been the experience of judges and courts and juries throughout the country on this problem. The statement points out this is only natural, since individual judgments, whether of a book or a magazine, a film, a play, or a painting, are inevitably subjective and personal. What may strike one man as pornographic may be a matter of complete indifference to another. What may be offensive to one person may be great art to another person. And frequently, such individual judgments condemn most severely only controversial expression, the very kind of speech for whose protection the First Amendment was written. Now, despite the 1957 ruling in the Supreme Court that material without redeeming social importance does not have the protection of the First Amendment, the ACLU said the drawing of a precise line between good and bad material is impossible. The statement said, "We do not say that every book or publication carries ideas of importance to the community, but we do believe that every act of deciding what should be barred carries with it a danger to the community. Because of the special need in a free society to guard against the stifling effect of censorship, no ban should be placed on allegedly obscene material, even though much material may be intensely disliked by many persons." The statement continued that this is never a popular position, but we are convinced it is the right one. The seeds of censorship have been planted in far too many areas of American life, usually with the intention of curing an evil. But rarely does the evil recede when censorship is imposed. The causes of such social problems as juvenile delinquency, which often prompt demands for censorship, are much deeper. Moreover, banning any expression only boosts interest in it and results in wider circulation of allegedly offensive material. The experience of prohibition has proved that. The statement pointed out that although urging acceptance of its no censorship position in order to strengthen the protections of free speech and free expression under the First Amendment, ACLU said it recognized that federal and state anti-obscenity laws do exist and are being invoked. When they are used, ACLU stressed the following standard should apply. Quote, "Any governmental restriction or punishment of any form of expression on the ground of obscenity must require proof beyond a reasonable doubt that such an expression would directly cause in a normal adult behavior which has validly been made criminal by statute." Close quote. This standard follows the ACLU's traditional clear and present danger position, under which free speech may be limited. If accepted, the prosecutions would at least relate to some definable criteria in an admittedly murky field. The statement said, if accepted, because the statement's position is not the prevailing standard in the United States Supreme Court. It has been recently urged in friend of the court briefs by the National ACLU to the Supreme Court. It was urged in the case of Jacobellis versus Ohio. The court did not reach the question of rejecting the Roth standard, but rather discussed contemporary community standards, and in that case pointed out that community standards must be national standards rather than limited to one local community. This position is again being urged before the Supreme Court in a case which has been accepted by the court for decision. Actually, it's two cases, United States versus Mishkin and the Ginsburg case. These cases are, I believe, have been argued before the Supreme Court, and we are awaiting a decision. But until that decision comes, the standard as it presently exists and must be applied by courts, either in court trials without juries or in instructions to juries in obscenity prosecutions, that material cannot be banned by statute unless the dominant theme of the work, applying contemporary national community standards, appeals to the prurient interest of the average individual and is without redeeming social importance. Now, in a later program, we'll have a chance to discuss in detail the problems that have occurred in Minnesota. Metropolitan Airports Commission action, the recent prosecution before the Hennepin County Court. It might be useful to note at this point that in this recent prosecution, the defense presented four expert witnesses who testified that the painting in question did have artistic merit, that is, redeeming social importance. And it was primarily on this basis that a finding of innocence was made. In the course of these programs, we have a number of speakers who have presented a panel session to a public audience for the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. The first speaker, and the speaker we will hear tonight, is John French, Minneapolis attorney who is former clerk to the late Felix Frankfurter, Justice of the United States Supreme Court, who will discuss contemporary standards, constitutional standards, as set down by the court. In the next program, we will hear from Gordon K. Haskell, a member of the national staff of the American Civil Liberties Union, who will discuss in more detail the national ACLU position, and Professor Edward Gerald, on leave from the University of Minnesota School of Journalism, who will present a point of view urging moderation in the American Civil Liberties Union position in this area. The last speaker is Dr. Reynold Jensen, a member of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union Board, who is Director of Child Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota Hospitals. Dr. Jensen will discuss in that program whether the reading, whether it has been shown scientifically, whether reading of allegedly obscene matter by juveniles can cause antisocial conduct, one of the very important issues involved in this controversy. And now we hear from John French, former clerk to the late Felix Frankfurter, Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
My happy task this evening is to try to outline the constitutional standards that form the framework for the discussion of censorship and obscenity. As I'm sure you understand, this topic presents its problems. The law has, on different occasions, been called a lot of different things. It's been called a jealous mistress and a seamless web, and so on and so forth. In the area that we're discussing, I think it might be called a will-o'-the-wisp. It's very difficult to define and more difficult to grasp. I don't mean to create the impression that this is peculiar. For one thing, the law in this area is very new. The Roth case, which is a landmark on this subject, was only decided in 1957, and it takes a good while for any subject of law, even a less controversial subject, to shake down and develop some firm guidelines. Beyond that, however, you should keep in mind that this is constitutional law, and there is often not very much law in the traditional sense in constitutional law. It's law, I suppose, because judges are required to make judgments about it in courts, but the content is often politics or theology or economics, and the controversial nature is clear. In any event, with respect to constitutional law, I remember remarking to Justice Frankfurter once that a law teacher had told me that the way the Supreme Court was reversing its prior decisions, there wasn't going to be any law left to teach, and all he would be able to teach would be the biographies of the justices. And the justice looked at me and said, "I never taught it any other way." You may find that a little cynical when applied to this topic, and I think he was stretching a point. But the fact is that here there is some reason to try to probe what the justices think as much as you try to probe what the law is or is not. In the first place, many of the cases in this area are decided per curiam, that is, by the court as a whole in the form of an order without an opinion attached. So you know what the result was, but you don't know the reasons. In many of the other cases, instead of following the customary format, having an opinion for the court and perhaps a dissent, perhaps no dissent, you find that there isn't any opinion for the court. There is a result, but one of the justices announces an opinion in which one or two others concur, and then perhaps three of them write separate concurrences, and one or two write dissents. And the result is that you don't know what the law of the case is. You know what each different justice thought about the case. So my approach to this problem will be to try to state, so far as I can, what I think the law is, and when I bog down, to supply what I think the justices think, which in the last analysis will ultimately provide the standards. There are two main subjects here, it seems to me. The first is, what is obscenity in the mind of the court? And the second is, once you've defined obscenity, what may you or may you not do about it? Now, approaching the first, the basic position is one that I think I can state with some confidence, because ever since the Roth and Alberts cases, 1957, there has been a consistent majority opinion. It's been a shifting majority, but a consistent majority, for the proposition that obscenity, whatever that may be, is not protected expression within the First and 14th Amendments. According to the court in the Roth case, the original framers of the Constitution did not intend to encompass obscenity in the protection of free speech, since they deemed obscenity, as the court put it, utterly without redeeming social importance. Now I have said everything that I can say, I think, about what the law is on obscenity, and I will embark into what the justices think about the problem. First and easiest are Justices Black and Douglas, who think that what I have just told you is wrong. They think that obscenity, whatever it is expression like any other form of expression and entitled to the same protections. As they put it, they would leave it to the judgment of the people to reject noxious literature in the same manner that they leave it to the judgment of the people to reject false theology or politics or economics. In all these cases, Justices Black and Douglas sometimes concur with a majority when it reverses a conviction, but they consistently state this separate concurrence also. Next, I think we can lump Justices Brennan, Goldberg, and White. Their view is, as I have said, that obscenity is without redeeming social importance and therefore not protected. To find out what is obscene, the test that they apply is whether or not the material is such that its dominant appeal, taken as a whole, is to the prurient interest. Isn't that nice? Now, as to what the prurient interest may be, there is some difficulty. There are expressions in opinions which indicate that a dominant appeal to the prurient interest would be an appeal to an exacerbated, morbid, or perverted interest in sex, or a tendency to arouse lustful thoughts, or to corrupt or deprave. The justices I'm describing recognize and have said so in a recent opinion that this is something less than a perfect verbalization of what they have in mind, but they don't think there's a better one, so they're going to stick with it. The test which they would apply is whether or not the material goes substantially beyond the customary limits of candor according to contemporary community standards. And they're quite clear that these standards must be national rather than local in order to preserve uniform application of the rule throughout the country. Justice Stewart, I think, agrees substantially with what I've just said about Justice Brennan and his colleagues, but he's considerably more explicit. He says that he thinks the gist of the cases and commentaries is that only, quote, hardcore pornography, close quote, is obscene. Now, he admits that he may not ever be able to define what hardcore pornography is, but he says, I know it when I see it. And that's his test. Justice Harlan also is in substantial agreement about the general principles with Justice Brennan, but he adds an important variation. He thinks that the authority of state governments should be different from the authority of federal governments in the regulation of obscenity. This is one of the rare occasions when a Supreme Court justice thinks the state should have more power than the federal government. He believes that the state has customarily had an interest in protecting its citizens from various personal sorts of offenses, and that this is the kind of legislation that might profitably be conducted by the states in accordance with the old Justice Brandeis theory that the states are laboratories for social experiment, and that what one may want to do, another may not. He thinks, on the other hand, that the federal interest in regulating pornographic material is much less strong and that the dangers of a uniform national rule are much greater. So he'd make this distinction. He also concedes that the formulation of the principle is very difficult. He says, in truth, the matter in the last analysis depends on how particular challenged material happens to strike the minds of jurors or judges, and ultimately those of a majority of this court. Finally, the Chief Justice and Justice Clark also adhere to this general test of dominant appeal to the prurient interest. But they would rely more on local community standards. They assert that there's no such thing as a national standard of what offends the consensus of the community, and they would look to local standards, and they would leave the decision largely to local juries and judges, subject only to a requirement that the record of the trial contain some significant evidence that the material was obscene. Well, in sum, I think the point to be made is that you really can't tell what the law is by listening to rules stating or attempting to state what it is. The only way you can really get at the problem is to see how the cases have been decided, not what the court has said, but what the court has done. Toward that end, here are a few of the many examples of kinds of cases that have been decided. I note that in each of these cases, the material was held not obscene, therefore not censorable. One case involved a French motion picture called The Game of Love. To quote a summary of that, this picture starts with an episode in which a 16-year-old boy is shown completely nude on a bathing beach in the presence of a group of younger girls as a result of a boating accident. And the picture goes on to depict a series of illicit sexual relations both with an older woman and a girl of his own age. In another case, the subject was a magazine called One, the homosexual magazine. This magazine appeared to have been composed without any scientific purpose and solely to appeal to the tastes and interests of homosexuals. A third case involved a magazine called Sunshine and Health, which is a nudist magazine, and which the lower court found obscene simply because it was too revealing. In all these cases, I remind you, the material was held not obscene. And I think what this demonstrates is that the court's understanding of obscenity is very, very narrow. These cases, plus a couple of other things, lead to this conclusion. For one thing, the Roth case, which was, as I've said, the leading case in this area, involved confiscation of materials by the post office. And although the materials themselves weren't the subject matter before the court, it was a more abstract question. The Solicitor General argued that about 90% of all materials seized by the post office are what would be called hardcore pornography. And to make his point, he shipped boxes and boxes of the stuff up to the court so it could circulate around and be seen by the justices so they'd know the kind of thing they were dealing with. And it seems very likely that this sort of thing was in the mind of the court when it was working on the case. It comes out in the opinion also when you find the court describing obscene material as material utterly without a redeeming social importance. I think the overall suggestion is that Justice Stewart is right and that whatever the judges say about the matter, only hardcore pornography is going to be held obscene. Now, this gives us another definitional problem, hardcore pornography. But there has been some good thought and writing on this subject. The best, I think, by Dean Lockhart and Professor McClure here at the University of Minnesota Law School. And they come to the conclusion, based on fairly deep study, that this probably refers to what they call daydream material, divorced from reality, whose main function is to nourish erotic fantasies of the sexually immature. They would go on to vary the standard somewhat and say that we must deal here not with material which is simply obscene in the abstract, but material which is treated as pornographic. Therefore, they would vary the result of the case depending on the audience that the material was aimed at. If somebody sold arguably obscene material to a scientific institution, they would hold that it was not treated as pornographic and therefore not censorable. On the other hand, if they sold it through an outlet that was erected in a shanty by the neighborhood junior high school, they would hold that it was directed to such an audience that it should be held pornographic. I might add that there is some recent encouragement for differentiation between material directed at adults and material directed at children. In the most recent opinion, the Jacobellis case, Justice Brennan goes out of his way to invite the states to draft statutes aimed particularly at preventing distribution to children rather than adults. Well, that, I think, in a nutshell, covers the question of what is obscene material. Now, very quickly, what may be done about it? Here the debate has been over the distinction between prior restraint and other methods of suppression. This started in a case called Near against Minnesota in 1931. This state had a statute which made any malicious, scandalous, or defamatory newspaper or other periodical subject to injunction from further publication as a nuisance. When the case got to the Supreme Court, it held the statute invalid as an unjustifiable prior restraint on publication of the paper. The difficulties were pointed up immediately in Justice Butler's dissent. He said he didn't understand how this could be prior restraint since the newspaper had already been published. As he understood it, prior restraint had to do with submitting something to a censor first and never getting it before the public at any time. That's where the battle lines have been drawn ever since. the result in Near against Minnesota does not mean that all restraints are unconstitutional. In a case called Kingsley Books, the court approved a procedure whereby material might be condemned and confiscated if it was found obscene, so long as future distribution of the same kind of material wasn't restrained. In other words, the state addressed itself only to the specific subject matter of the litigation, and the bookseller could run the risk of peddling the same thing again and having it confiscated. And in the Times Film case in 1961, the court held that in the abstract, and it was very abstract, it could not be said that no state requirement of submission of films to some administrative agency for examination prior to exhibition would definitely be bad. They permitted this kind of prior censorship and said that there, under some circumstances, surely it will be lawful. We won't say it's unlawful per se. On the other hand, there was a very strong four-man dissent in the Times Film case, and Times Film has been quite sharply restricted in a series of cases since that time, which I won't trouble you with here, except the last. The last case, called Friedman against Maryland, was decided only 6 weeks ago, and the holding there is that any censorship system must place the burden of proving obscenity on the censor, and it must provide for a speedy judicial determination of the question. In other words, a censor can't take a movie, announce that he believes it to be obscene, and therefore will not license it, and leave it to the exhibitor of the film to take the case to court and proceed through tedious and sometimes excessively time-consuming steps in order to get this judgment reversed. Where we stand on this question, I think, then, is back about at the position of the dissent in Times Film, namely that there can't be any sanctions imposed without a prior adjudication in a court. And for the reasons why we have probably ended up here, I will refer to the dissent in Times Film and read you a few excerpts. First, here are the kinds of censorship instances that were brought to the attention of the court and caused the four-man dissent to find the dangers of censorship so great. A revelation of the extent to which censorship has recently been used in this country is indeed astonishing. The Chicago licensors have banned newsreel films of Chicago policemen shooting at labor pickets and have ordered the deletion of a scene depicting the birth of a buffalo in Walt Disney's Vanishing Prairie. Before World War II, the Chicago censor denied licenses to a number of films portraying and criticizing life in Nazi Germany, including The March of Times inside Nazi Germany. Recently, Chicago refused to issue a permit for the exhibition of the motion picture Anatomy of a Murder, based upon the best-selling novel of the same title, because it found the use of the words rape and contraceptive to be objectionable. The Memphis censors banned The Southerner, which dealt with poverty among tenant farmers, because it reflects on the South. No Way Out, the story of a Negro doctor's struggle against race prejudice, was banned by the Chicago censor on the ground that there's a possibility it could cause trouble. The principal objection to the film was that the conclusion showed no reconciliation between blacks and whites. The ban was lifted after a storm of protest and later deletion of a scene showing Negroes and whites arming for a gang fight. Memphis banned Curly because it contained scenes of white and Negro children in school together. The New York censors banned Damaged Lives, a film dealing with venereal disease, although it treated a difficult theme with dignity and had the sponsorship of the American Social Hygiene Society. The picture of Lenin's tomb bearing the inscription, "Religion is the opiate of the people," was excised from Potemkin. From Joan of Arc, the Maryland board eliminated Joan's exclamation as she stood at the stake, "O God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And from Idiot's Delight, the sentence, "We, the workers of the world, will take care of that." Professor Mamlock was produced in Russia and portrayed the prosecution of the Jews by Nazis. The Ohio censors condemned it as harmful and calculated to stir up hatred and ill will and gain nothing. It was released only after substantial deletions were made. The police refused to permit its showing in Providence, Rhode Island. Charlie Chaplin's satire on Hitler, the great dictator, was banned in Chicago, apparently out of deference to its large German population. The New York censors forbade the discussions in films of pregnancy, venereal disease, eugenics, birth control, abortion, illegitimacy, prostitution, miscegenation, and divorce. A member of the Chicago censor board rejected a film because it was immoral, corrupt, indecent, and against my religious principles. A police sergeant attached to the censor board explained, "Coarse language or anything that would be derogatory to the government, propaganda, is ruled out of foreign films. Nothing pink or red is allowed," he added. The police sergeant in charge of the censor unit has said, "Children should be allowed to see any movie that plays in Chicago. If a picture is objectionable for a child, it is objectionable, period." And this is but a smattering produced from limited research. Now, addressing myself briefly to the question why prior restraint is worse in the eyes of the court than subsequent punishment, I read again from the Times film dissent. "The instant litigation has now consumed almost 3 years. This is the delay occasioned by the censor. This is the injury done to the free communication of ideas. This damage is not inflicted by the ordinary penalties. The threat of these penalties, intelligently applied, will ordinarily be sufficient to deter the exhibition of obscenity. However, if the exhibitor believes that his film is constitutionally protected, he will show the film, and if prosecuted under criminal statute, will have ready that defense. The perniciousness of a system of censorship is that the exhibitor's belief that his film is constitutionally protected is irrelevant. Once the censor has made his estimation that the film is bad and has refused to issue a permit, there is ordinarily no defense to a prosecution for showing the film without a license. Thus, the film is not shown, perhaps not for years and sometimes not ever. Moreover, more likely than not, the exhibitor will not pursue judicial remedies. His inclination may well be simply to capitulate rather than initiate a long and costly litigation. It is axiomatic that the stroke of the censor's pen or the cut of his scissor will be a less contemplated decision than will be the prosecutor's determination to prepare a criminal indictment. The standards of proof, the judicial safeguards afforded a criminal defendant, and the consequences of bringing such charges will all provoke the mature deliberation of the prosecutor. None of these hinder the quick judgment of the censor, the speedy determination to suppress. Finally, the fear of the censor by the composer of ideas acts as a substantial deterrent to the creation of new thoughts." As I said, I think this is really roughly where we are. Although I'm reading from a dissent, I think it has become the law as of 6 weeks ago, if not before that time. Procedurally, lest it be thought that this leaves us nowhere and there's nothing whatever that can be done, I should point out that in this most recent decision, Friedman against Maryland, the court recommended a course of action by pointing out as a model for a censorship system the system presented to the court in the Kingsley Books case. Describing the system, it says, "That procedure postpones any restraint against sale until a judicial determination of obscenity following notice and an adversary proceeding. The statute provides for a hearing 1 day after joinder of issue. The judge must hand down his decision within 2 days after termination of the hearing." So I think it is still possible by, in sum, by proceeding through courts rather than through administrative agencies to enjoin the distribution of obscene material. I withdraw that remark. Not to enjoin it, but to confiscate it. within the narrow limits with which obscene material, I think, has come to be defined, namely as hardcore pornography. As you can see, this is a difficult problem, but I think it would be well to understand that its difficulty lies not with the incompetence of the court, which, as I found, is made up of relatively intelligent men. It lies rather with the inherent controversiality and perplexity of the problem. It's a problem involving definition and very fine distinctions. And when you have such a situation, you always run into difficulties. Once a young man who was trying to write a speech approached Benjamin Disraeli, who was then Prime Minister of England, and said, "Mr. Disraeli, I'm having difficulty. I'm composing a speech, and I don't know how to make proper use of the words catastrophe and calamity. I wonder if you could help me." And Mr. Disraeli said that he thought he could. He said, "This should give you some idea. I'm sure that you and I and the entire nation would think it a catastrophe if Mr. Gladstone were to fall into the Thames. On the other hand, I think that you, and I know that I, and many other people, would think it a calamity if anyone were ever to pull him out." Thank you very much.
That was John French, former clerk to Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, speaking on the constitutional standards of censorship of obscenity. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. I think in his discussion, the reasons behind the American Civil Liberties Union approach to the problem of censorship are well pointed out. In his description of the kinds of things that have been censored by the film censorship boards located in many states around the country, things from Walt Disney's movies to any unpopular political expression, shows the danger of any censorship system. Where it might start out to be, "We are only trying to censor obscene materials." It has been our experience in state after state and city after city that if unconstitutional censorship is allowed to go unchecked, it reaches into literature, into art, into many of the fields, areas of expression, unpopular political opinions, perhaps even popular in areas where the censorship does not occur. If you would like a brochure explaining the American Civil Liberties Union views on censorship of obscenity, we invite you to send your name and address to American Civil Liberties Union, Minnesota Branch, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota, or just to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. In the next program on censorship of obscenity, we will hear a discussion by Gordon K. Haskell, Director of Membership and Development of the National American Civil Liberties Union staff, speaking on the National ACLU position on obscenity. We will also hear from Professor Edward Gerald, on leave from the Journalism School of the University of Minnesota, who presents a view arguing moderation of the American Civil Liberties Union position. This has been the first in a series of programs dealing with the civil liberties problems of censorship of obscenity, and the 11th in a series of programs produced by Minnesota Civil Liberties Union as a public service.